Let me take that one, Dan. The first, in an equivalent position, you have to look at it from the in the context of the organization or the legal form that the firm has elected to choose. Most firms choose to be a partnership or a LLP. In that form, we would expect the engagement quality reviewer to be a partner in the firm. And that's why we emphasized in the release that when you have that form, that structure, then the partner has the appropriate level of authority, and as long as they, again, meet all the qualifications to perform this engagement quality review. And we emphasized that obviously it could not be a manager, because they're not at that level of authority in the firm. Now, having said that, there are other forms, though, of organizations. There might be corporations where the firm may have shareholders, or commonly referred to as members. And those members, then, would be a person in an equivalent position to perform this role in engagement quality review. And that's the context of the way we've tracked this standard.
Okay, that makes sense. So I think what you said then, tell me if I'm right, is if we are a partnership and have partners, then only a partner can perform the review. There's no one who would be in an equivalent position to a partner in a partnership. If we don't have partners, if we have members or whatever we might happen to call them, then we have to look at the group that's equivalent to partners. Is that correct?
That's correct. We have to look at the group, right.
So this won't be something where we'll have to perform an interpretive function then?
I don't think we'd have to provide any interpretation on this one. With respect to the in-house engaging quality reviewer, I think it would be apparent.
Okay, let's turn then to the issue that I think concerned the commentators the most, that is the standard for when the concurring approval could be issued. And again, as Dima, I think, outlined, in the original standard, the reviewer was prohibited from providing the concurring approval if he or she knows or should know, based upon the requirements of the standard, that it would be, your opinion, would be inappropriate or incorrect. In the re-proposal, the test would be whether, after performing with due professional care the required reviewer is not aware of a significant engagement deficiency. Now, I know that at least one of the comment letters objected to any legal language, but let me ask a legal question anyway. Is this a negligence standard?
I would defer to legal counsel for that one.
Do I give a legal answer to that question? The re-proposed standard the staff is recommending today would refer specifically to AU 230, the auditor's existing duty to act with due professional care. That standard requires an auditor to carry out their professional responsibilities with reasonable care and diligence, which is a negligence standard. So I think
it's like
a fair way from a legal
perspective.
I think that's right, yeah.
How does that compare to the standard that the members of the engagement team
Well, the members of the engagement team, of course, as auditors, have a similar responsibility to act with due professional care, so in that respect, it's the same. Of course, that said, the engagement team and the engagement partner in particular have broader responsibilities than the E2R reviewer, so whatever the scope of their responsibilities, though, those responsibilities must be carried out with due professional care.
It's the same, and in fact, as you suggested, it comes from the same place in the underlying auditing.
Right.
And just one more along these lines. There is at least one federal appellate case on the responsibilities of concurring partners, and I guess there are a number of SEC releases besides. How would you compare the standard in the re-proposal to the case law standard with respect to the liability of concurring partners? The Potts case, I guess, is the only appellate case I'm aware of.
Yeah, there are very few. I believe there are more than one. But we think the re-proposed standard is consistent with the case law. I think both the SEC and the Federal Court of Appeals you referred to in the Eighth Circuit in the Potts decision have said that the engagement quality reviewer has a responsibility to carry out their review with due professional care. And again, that is the standard that's articulated in the re-proposal before you today.
Okay, well, we'll try not to use any more legal language. Let's turn to documentation. Again, I think you touched on this in your comments. There certainly were some objections in the comment letters to the level of documentation that the commenters thought that we envisioned with respect to the EQR. The original proposal called for documentation of things like the areas of engagement subject to the engagement quality review, procedures performed, and the results of those procedures. And I understand what we have before us now. It's been cut back now to more focus. Oh, I don't know. I'll let you say whether it's cut back, but it focuses now more on significant discussions held by the engagement team and the documents that the concurrent reviewer looked at. Maybe a preliminary question. What's the objective of EQR documentation? Is this essentially to support our inspection program, or because it's hard to evaluate the requirements without knowing what you're trying to accomplish? What would you say the objective is?
I would say that the objective of the documentation of the EQR is to provide a record of the EQR process. And the EQR is an important part of the audit, and it's beneficial for both the board and the firm to have a record of this process. As you mentioned, it's beneficial for the board because, for example, inspectors will have a better documentation of the procedures performed by the engagement code reviewer and others who assisted him or her. And then the documentation that was available for the concurrent partner reviews performed under the existing standard. And it's going to be beneficial for the firm because the firm will have a record of this important process. The firm may use it, for example, for planning the future EQRs, and it will be a record of the discussions held and the significant issues that were addressed during the review.
Oh, okay. How would you compare the level of documentation that the revised proposal would require of the EQR to the requirements of auditing standard number 3? Is it essentially requiring the same level of documentation as if we applied that standard to the reviewer?
I would say there are quite a few differences. If you reflect back on AS3, the premise behind AS3 is the engagement team is to document the procedures performed, the evidence obtained, and conclusions reached. Now you compare that to the engagement quality reviewer. What he or she is required to document those procedures performed, but those procedures are discussions with engagement team and review of selected documents. He or she gains no evidence, and then he or she arrives at a final conclusion, concurring approval of issues or no concurring approval of issues. So there's quite a distinction between the two.
Okay, that's helpful. Well, let me ask a slightly more technical question. The revised proposal requires documentation of significant discussions. What's a significant discussion? Or maybe a better question is, what's an insignificant discussion?
I'd say, depending on the size of a particular engagement, there may be more or fewer discussions between the engagement team and the reviewer. Especially on larger engagements, there may be numerous discussions, and they may span several months, the duration of the engagement. And I just want to be clear that the new proposal does not require necessarily that every such discussion be documented. There may be information gathering discussions when the reviewer gathers some background on a particular issue. If that background is not regularly available in the documentation, engagement documentation, for whatever other reason, or there may be discussions where the engagement team provides a status update to the reviewer on a particular issue, and the discussion would just be limited to the question, are you done with the issue and has it been resolved to? And the answer may be no, in which case this is maybe an insignificant discussion. Here's an example.
It doesn't really bear on the
exactly. And to your point, in the release, the staff proposes to include a helpful guidance as to what the significant discussion would be. It's a discussion on which the reviewer relies upon for providing concurrent approval of issuance.
One more question in the general documentation area before we leave that. The original proposal had a paragraph in it, or a statement in it, that the reviewer should evaluate whether the engagement team's work papers meet the requirements of AS3 in the areas that were subject to the EQR review. And that statement has simply disappeared from the re-proposal. And what do you intend in terms of the reviewer's responsibilities, if any, for whether the engagement team is complying with AS3?
Some of the commenters, when they read this requirement, they interpreted it as a requirement for the reviewer to go from A to Z on a particular matter that he or she is discussing with the engagement team. So, for example, if it's revenue recognition, that every single binder that's included in the engagement documentation should be read by the reviewer. And this is not necessarily what the reviewer would do in every single case. There might be cases when, I'll give you, for an example, the engagement completion document is so comprehensive that it provides all of the documentation of a particular issue that the reviewer needs to understand, to comply with the provisions of the standard. In another extreme case, the reviewer may need to go through all of the documentation to understand what has been done or to comply with the provisions of the standard. So the commenters interpreted that provision for the review, the AS3, the mention of AS3 in the original proposal, as a requirement to review everything. In the new proposal, we do not mention AS3 to emphasize that the reviewer does have flexibility in determining what level of documentation is required in a particular case, based on facts and circumstances.
Well, let's stick with the engagement completion document. Let's say that the reviewer looks at that and determines that it's inadequate, or at least that it doesn't meet the requirements of the standard. What's his obligation?
The standard certainly does not prohibit the reviewer to sort of dig deeper and ask the engagement team for more documentation in order to understand the issue. If the reviewer determines that there is an issue that has to be addressed by the engagement team, he or she should communicate this to the engagement team, and secondly, ensure that the issue has been resolved before providing the concurrent approval of issuance.
Well, that's sort of what I was trying to say. I assume that if he looks at the memo and says, hey, this doesn't meet the requirements of the standard, he has an obligation to say to the team, you guys need to expand this memo.
That's right.
He clearly has an obligation because that particular issue could be construed as a significant engagement deficiency, whereby that, as Dima mentioned, then that would prohibit the engagement quality reviewer from providing concurrent approval of issuance.
Let me turn to consultations. A number of the comments were concerned that we didn't say anything at all about the ability of the engagement quality reviewer to communicate with management and the audit committee. I mean, some complained that we might be requiring him or her to do that, but in terms of communications more aimed at transmitting information about the audit and being part of the relationship with the client. And we continue to be silent on that. We haven't made any change in that regard. What do you all envision or intend in that regard? Is it okay? Say the audit committee asked to speak to the reviewer. How should the reviewer respond to such a request?
The audit committee, your example there, Dan, with the audit committee, could be audit committee or any member of the board or member of management. If they so choose, they can certainly talk to and enter into a dialogue with the engagement quality reviewer. And that's not prohibited by the standard. In fact, that type of dialogue is encouraged in order for the board or audit committee to discharge their responsibilities. This standard is in qualifying as an engaged quality viewer, they have to at all times maintain their objectivity. But this would not impair their objectivity in having a dialogue with an audit committee member or any member of management or the board. Because that type of dialogue and discussions can be helpful to the audit committee members as they carry out their duties, because they may have some specific questions or concerns about certain issues that perhaps this particular person can assist them in gaining certain insights.
Okay, so we're certainly, I think you may have said, encouraged. We're certainly not trying to discourage the communication anyway. And just briefly, you touched on it, but the other kind of consultation, is it okay for the engagement team to approach the EQR reviewer and say, gee, you know, we have a difficult issue here. What's your advice on how we should?
On that particular issue,
these receivables or, you know, whatever the problem might be.
When the a member of the engagement team approaches the engagement quality reviewer, then when they approach them, though, the team should have gathered the evidence, analyzed the evidence, and come up with a preliminary solution to what the issue may be, and then bring in the engagement quality reviewer, because you do not want the engagement quality reviewer to, again, as I mentioned earlier, gather evidence. If you do not want to place that person in a role where he or she may be reviewing their own work. So it's important that the members of the engagement team do all the preliminary work and then approach the engagement quality reviewer for his or her insights on that particular issue.
Is it fair to say that it's analogous to the relationship that the client might have with the auditor with respect to an accounting issue?
Very similar. Very similar analogy, yes.
Last but not least, the effective date. The release says at the end that the revised standard would be effective for annual audits for fiscal years ending on or after December 15, 2009, and for interim reviews for fiscal years beginning after December 15, 2009. Maybe, Fritz, could you explain in English what that means? In practical terms, what that means?
Let's start with the audit first. The audit would, what you mentioned, Dan, would be for... It would be for all of the issuers that have fiscal years that end on or after December 15th of this year would have to have an engagement quality review pursuant to this proposed standard. And so that would be for the audit. When it would be the first time it would begin for the audit. Now, interim reviews, though, we took into consideration that interim reviews we would need a little more time. We couldn't make it effective this year, and we preferred to have the interim reviews effective with the first interim review of a fiscal year. And so that's why we put in the release they would be effective for the first interim review of fiscal years beginning after December 15th of 2009 of this year.
All right, well, holding all that in mind, and then keeping in mind that we have many firms in this country, including the very largest, that are currently performing concurrent partner reviews in accordance with the existing standard and their own internal firm procedures, and then we also have a number of firms, some in this country and some outside, that aren't performing concurrent reviews at all, how long do you think it'll take for firms to put in place the procedures to satisfy the new standards, and so what level of preparation do they need to be making now, I guess, given that we can't say whether we're going to adopt this standard in precisely its existing form until we get the comments in order to be able to meet those deadlines.
Let me break it down between the firms that are complying with the current requirement, then I'll talk about the firms that were not members of the SEC practice section and not complying with the current requirement. First of all, the ones that are currently complying with the current requirement, if they have been complying with the spirit of the of our current requirement, then they don't have, this is not a dramatic change to their current policies and procedures that they would have to make. We notified the firms as well as the public that we were going to make changes back last year in February. So the firms have been put on notice that we're making some changes, and they're well aware of that. And they're well aware with this proposal of what we would like to move forward with. So they can, they have adequate time to get the changes in place, any tweaks they need to make for their audits, and then subsequently for the interim reviews. Now, for those firms that are not currently having a concurring partner or engaging quality reviewer review the audits and interim reviews, for those, I would suggest that we're sending out the, of course, they were aware of the notice last year, and they're going to see a new release this year. But first of all, they need to, for all their issuer audit engagements, they need to make sure they have a person qualified to do the work. They can plan ahead now to get that person, whether it's in-house or outside, make sure they have someone lined up. And then, going forward, for the interim reviews that will take place after December 15th, they need to go ahead and also line up those people and make sure that they have their schedule permits, that they schedule permits them the time to perform the timely interim reviews that would be required of them.
Start now.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have, and I appreciate your letting me have so much time.
Charlie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, one danger in going after Dan is there's very little left on the ground there. I'd also want to thank the staff, in particular, Greg, you and Dima, as well as Jake Lesser, for all your hard work. I believe you've thoughtfully and thoroughly analyzed the comments we've received, as well as the goals board members have expressed. The product today not only reflects all that work, but also reflects your untiring commitment to developing standards that put investor protection first. And I do not say that lightly, because, in fact, there were a lot of calls to weaken the proposal. I'm only disappointed that reproposing means further delays in important investor protections. Our inspections continue to find serious audit deficiencies at both large and small firms, and better engagement quality reviews could and should catch those deficiencies to prevent investor harm. At the same time, I am comfortable that today's proposal retains the investor protections of the original proposal and indeed has benefited from refinement. Importantly, the proposal clearly states that reviewers are responsible for identifying and following up on the problem. I believe some auditors have mistakenly believed that following the preferable principle of see no evil, speak no evil is a good approach for a reviewer. To the contrary, that approach has never shielded reviewers from liability when they fail to address problems that a reasonably diligent reviewer should have found and followed up on. The proposal describes a better approach for both auditors and investors. The original proposal prevented an auditor from providing concurrent approval if he or she knew or should have known of a problem. Some commenters seemed alarmed at that standard, although in fact that's the standard that applies today. Another way to articulate it is to say that reviewers must exercise due care. Due care may be a more familiar standard, and it may sound a little less legal, like legalese, and that's fine, since they both get to the same place. There have also been other refinements, and I will not go into them in detail. We've already gone into most of them in detail, which is good. And in general, those refinements attempt to correct mistaken impressions that commenters seem to have had, such as that the EQR is intended to be a re-audit. It's intended to be rigorous, and I think our inspection record amply demonstrates renewed vigor is justified. But it is not intended to be a re-audit. I also would like to say to Tom, Ray, thank you very much for all your years of dedication and hard work and leadership. You may have been the director of standards for the last 3 years, but you've been with us from the very beginning. And, at a time when there was only a handful of us, you believed enough in the mission to take the chance to join us, and I truly appreciate it. And best of luck in whatever you do. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
First, I want, of course, want to join my colleagues in this expression of thanks to all the staff, and a special thank you to Tom for his efforts during the years we've all worked together. Sarbanes-Oxley permits the PCOB to adopt interim standards, which the board has done. And Sarbanes-Oxley permits the PCOB to revise the interim standards, which is why we're here today. But as I read Sarbanes-Oxley, at least Section 103, my reading is that it directs the board to include in its standards a requirement for an engagement quality review for each audit of a U.S. issuer. And we, and I include myself in this comment, have failed to do this, and 6 years have gone by. While the board wisely continues to consider an improved engagement quality review standard, auditors of foreign private issuers and domestic auditors who are not members of the SEC practice section when the PCOB adopted its interim standards are exempt, continue so far, to be exempt from this requirement. I would have preferred to extend the interim standards to all registered firms at the same time that the board acts to perfect the engagement quality review standard itself. And I regret this hasn't happened, and will continue to look for opportunities to act sooner rather than later on this important investor protection. There's a big loophole out there, and it continues. Thank you.
Steve. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's difficult to follow Dan, it's even more difficult to follow you, Dan, Charlie, and Bill. But the engagement quality review proposed standard we are considering today is a very important issue for auditors and investors alike. An engagement quality review is one of the primary methods many audit firms use to verify the quality of their own work. It is also a quality assurance measure that allows investors to rely upon an audit opinion when making their investment decisions. At year-end 2008, about 45% of all American households were invested in financial markets through mutual funds. That's 92 million individual shareholders, according to a study released last month by the Investment Company Institute. Congress had the investing public in mind in 2002 when the Sarbanes-Oxley Act mandated a whole new slate of investor protections. One directed the PCAOB board to require this quality assurance process, a second part in review and approval for every audit of every U.S. public company. The engagement quality review proposal we are considering today has been underway for quite some time, and I'm glad to see it finally nearing conclusion. Poorly performed second partner reviews are among the more frequently observed concerns cited in the board's inspection reports. The time and effort the board and staff devoted to consideration of the comments received when EQR was first proposed last February is evident in the standard we are talking about reproposing today. Joining the other board members, I want to thank the standard team led by Greg and Dima and Jake and the General Counsel's Office for their hard work. And I also want to join all the board members in commending Tom for your outstanding work. I've only been here for 7 months, but it's been apparent, and I join the other members in wishing you all success and all the best, and thank you for a job well done. I also want to thank the public commentators who took the time to provide the valuable input and suggestions that are reflected in today's proposal. Many commended the board for proposing an EQR standard and noted that a well-performed engagement quality review is, in the words of one writer, a, quote, pillar, close quote, of audit quality. The board, as other members have noted, received a number of comments. A strong supporter of the original standard wrote, quote, all parties to the audit, the audit firm, the public company audit, and the investing public have a public interest in engagement quality review being robust and effective, close quote. Other commentators, as has been noted, including some issuers and registered firms, were critical of the proposal. They believed it would significantly increase the time required to perform the review. These commentators suggested it would amount to a re-audit. To correct this, they asked for clarifications on a number of the standards requirements. The revised proposal before us today makes clear that an engagement quality review is not intended to be a re-audit. It directs the reviewer to evaluate the significant judgments made and conclusions reached by the engagement team, to hold discussions with the engagement team, and to review documentation. The proposal also addresses the board concerns about the performance of second partner reviews that I mentioned are frequently cited in inspection reports.
It specifies and enhances the reviewer's responsibility to validate audit quality. By requiring registered firms to provide every audit engagement with a competent, independent reviewer, emphasizing the integrity and objectivity of the process, the EQR standard would significantly further the board's mission to protect investors. The modifications to the original proposal respond to the comments we received by clarifying the requirements for the reviewer and the quality of the review. For example, the revised proposal includes the following: a clearly stated objective for the reviewer that is consistent with specific requirements for the engagement quality review, a refinement of reviewer qualifications that requires the reviewer to be a partner or similar member of the firm or to be unaffiliated with the firm, a requirement that an audit engagement partner be prohibited from serving as the reviewer on that engagement for at least 2 years, a requirement that EQRs for interim reviews be tailored to address the specific procedures performed during those reviews, and a clarification of documentation requirements, including identification of the reviewer, the documents reviewed, a description of any significant discussions that took place, and the date a concurring approval was made. This approach requires a thoughtful and meaningful review of the work performed by the engagement team. For all these reasons, I support this proposal. I believe that it can improve audit quality and give investors the consistent and credible information they need to make informed judgments about their financial future. As such, I am anxious to see the board adopt the final standard as soon as possible, with the implementation of these requirements no later than the end of the year. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Steve and board members. Tom, is there anything you'd like to say to the group on your last time here? We should give you time if you'd like.
Well, thanks. Just briefly, it's been great to be here. I wish you all the best. CCAOB is extraordinarily important and will continue to be so. Thanks for the great opportunity to be here. Okay.
Thank you again. There's no further discussion. I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Carried. There's no further business. This concludes our agenda today, and the meeting is now adjourned. Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Dima. Thank you, Elder Druid. We will rise from the open meeting and reconvene in the closed meeting in a little over 5 minutes.